So here's what happens as a proud member of the Wide Low podcast community. Hey guys, welcome to another episode of So Here's What Happened. I am your host, Nisha, and I am joined by my lovely co-host,
Carolyn. Hey.
Hey, y'all. We are back. We are back. Nothing happened. We are back. It's just been a very long August, I feel like. August is like a Sunday of the months, so it comes quick. And it feels long, and then it goes by fast. But anywho, a lot has happened in August, and I'm excited to get into it and chat with Carolyn about what she has watched and read, seeing how she's have you completed all your coverage now?
I still have TIFF coming up. But
oh, that's right.
But what I'll be talking about today is Fantasia Fest and the New York Asian Film Festival.
Awesome. Well, then let's just dive right in. I'm going to be honest with y'all. Grad school started, and I'm not reading anything that's not textbooks right now. So, like, unless anybody want to come read for me, I'm going to forego my book. And Carolyn, if you have anything you want to mention for the book corner, go right ahead.
I haven't really read anything this month, also because I've been like watching films mostly and dramas. Right. But what I'll say is, like, the last episode I discussed Dark Blood, which is the comic written and created by LaToya Morgan. And that one, volume two, has come out. And I talked about the first volume in the previous episode. And volume two has come out. And from my understanding, I believe volume one has also gone into a second and perhaps a third printing. So, like, which is really good for a brand new comic and one written by a Black woman and created by a Black woman. And it's a story about Black characters. Like, the central character is a Black man. And as I said, it's set just around the end of the Second World War. So that's an interesting story that you can get into. And it's distributed by Boom Studios. I always keep saying, I want to say Boom Comics all the time, but that's not what it is. It's Boom Studios. So that's what it's distributed by. So you can go on their site and check out where you can find the comics are ordered directly from their site, or, you know, if you can, buy from a local comic book store. Support your local stores if you can. And I think that's it for me for the book corner today.
Nice. Well, we will go right into TV. I'm fine with going first because, shockingly enough, I fell back into The Walking Dead. Oh. Well, kind of Fear of the Walking Dead, because I believe me and Carolyn had our rant, I think, at one point where we were just like, how y'all gonna do this to us? How y'all gonna do Rick and Michonne like this? And it was like early on when we started our show, and we just had a full on like rant fest about like that whole thing. Cause supposedly whenever we're supposed to get those movies, I don't know, they should be reunited, but we're not gonna get into Walking Dead exactly. I'm gonna get into the Fear of the Walking Dead, which I kind of binged with my little sister. She's been getting into, I told her about Walking Dead a while ago. She finally started watching it. And then we both just like watched Fear the Walking Dead together. And I did not expect myself to get into it as much, but I think it's just like, it's refreshing to see the story and the world of The Walking Dead from a different perspectives, which, like, yeah, it's an American post-apocalyptic horror drama. By the same team. It's just a spinoff taking place, and they start off in California, I believe. Yeah. Then they move to Mexico. Then they move to, well, then they're at sea for a bit. Then it's Mexico. And then it's like they're very similar to Rick's group. You have like the core group of people that start off, and they're just trying to find a place so that they can build something and that they can have something. I will say, however, this was probably the first time when I was waiting for everybody in the group to die.
Oh, wow.
Just because I was irritated by the mother, very irritated by that woman, very irritated by the son, very irritated by the daughter. The one person,
because I watched the first season, and that was kind of my, I think that they annoyed me so much that that was the reason why I dropped the show. I never got into the second. I think I watched like maybe the first two episodes of the second season, and then I never picked it back.
Yeah, I made it through just because of the strength of this would be what me and my little sister would watch when she would come over as a weekly thing. Like, oh, you're coming over? It's our night. Like, let's just, you know, have wine and watch this. And like, that's what we would be watching. And I'd just be like, so when is she going to die? When is he going to die? Like, that was, I was just like fed up with specifically the mother. Just because the way she handles everything, I'm just like, if this white woman don't go sit down, because I understand they're trying to make her come off as this very strong and capable woman. But I also feel like, especially in, I think it's the third and fourth season, when you bring in the indigenous people and then the people on the white people on the ranch, and the dude who's the head of the ranch is just basically a white racist who is like, you know, he's like, well, we don't trust them and this and that, and they're not welcomed here. And just like, okay, but does anybody see how the brown people have done nothing wrong here? And I'm 100% on their side if they go ahead and kill everybody. And if they become the main cast, I'm totally fine with that, because I just didn't see anything wrong with any of those people at all, because they had reasons. They presented their case and I liked all of them. Whereas the mother and the son and the daughter is less annoying, but then she has her moments where she's very annoying. But the mother, just like,
you're like, why are you here again?
She's annoying. And I'm like, I miss the dad. You know, I liked him. He was great. I mean, the acting's pretty good. It takes place in The Walking Dead, y'all. Like, for people who aren't familiar with it, I say give it a watch. I think it's very interesting. And maybe if you are burnt out from The Walking Dead and you need a break from it, because I know this is the last season of The Walking Dead, give Fear the Walking Dead a try, because like, it's very interesting to see how all of this is taking place. And you get to see, I do love how we get to see how the zombie outbreak started in Fear the Walking Dead. However, the most exciting thing that I'm in right now is when Morgan finally appears. So Morgan's arc of Fear the Walking Dead, of him crossing over, because he does make it from Virginia to this crew, and he becomes the centered focus of it. I love Morgan. He's a very complex character, and he goes through a lot. So I'm worried about what this means for him.
What season are you in?
I'm at the tail end of season 4.
Because I think they're filming, or they just recently wrapped the last season, right?
Which was they finished the last season of The Walking Dead. So
and they also just filmed the last season of Fear the Walking Dead too?
Did they? Oh, I didn't know it was the last season of that one too. Well, look, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure I saw something. Let me see. Fear the Walking Dead.
Like, I know that one's still ongoing, and we are at 6 seasons of that one. But
okay, yeah, okay. So they filmed season 7, and it will premiere on October the 17th.
Okay.
So, yeah, because Lenny James, who is Morgan, apparently he's still alive. So, spoiler, but I'm giving you the assurance that at least the black man is still alive.
I'm happy if Morgan stays alive. I'm totally fine with him surviving this. But the other people, you know, we'll see if y'all make it to Virginia and if you meet up with Rick and them. Well, Rick is supposedly, quote unquote, dead. But by now, it's been 3 years. We know Rick's not dead. He got picked up in that helicopter to God knows where. And I'm just trying to be patient to see if we're ever going to see Andrew Lincoln ever again.
He's in something. He's going to be in a new series by Guillermo del Toro. And it's an anthology series, but I don't know if all the stories in the different episodes are going to cross over. But yeah, it was announced recently he got Guillermo del Toro started a new anthology series, and Andrew Lincoln is one of the stars. So I don't think we'll be seeing him back in the Walking Dead universe anytime soon. And I mean, the way how they killed him off, like, people were like, we know he's not dead, so why are you doing this? Either kill him off or just don't. But I think it was probably like Angelique was like, you know, I don't really need to stay around, just like peace out. Because they were going to do a film to him. People were like, why?
Why do a film that, like, truthfully, people will... I want to see it. I want to see the movie just so we can wrap up and have closure for Michonne and Rick. Because Michonne has left in search of Rick at this point
on The Walking Dead. How long has she been gone?
I mean,
last 2 seasons at least.
Yeah, 2 seasons ago she left. So she's supposed to join him in whatever film, but at this point, just make it a mini series.
Like, Guerrero's out there doing her own thing.
I mean, true, she booked and busy, which we love to see it, but I also just want closure. So We'll see. But nonetheless, let's move on to films. Oh, wait, did you have any TV or anything?
Yeah, so my TV shows are going to be, I'm going to discuss just two K-dramas. One is DP, that's what it stands for. And the funny thing is there a DP and there's no acronym for what, we don't know what the acronym stands for because it's about career. I think it's probably Deserter Patrol. That's what I'm interpreting at. Because the premise of the show is An Jun-ho, played by Jung Hae-in, my boo, is a soldier and he is quiet and calm but inflexible. And then there's Sergeant Park Bom-gu, played by Kim Sung-kyun, notices Private An Go-hun's tenacity and ability to observe, and he transfer An Jung-ho to the DP, Deserter Pursuit Team. And their mission is to catch deserters from the South Korean army. So for South Korea, like they are every young man, once they want, there has to between the ages of 18 to 29, have to enlist. So they have, like, you can choose, you have to, and you have that time period, and so you serve around up to 2 years. And then there's some people who join army because they want a career in the army, and then there's some people, and then there's others who enlist because that's their patriotic duty. And so this is about, so An Jun-ho, played by An Jung-hae-in, he is he his job is to, while he's enlisted, is to serve in Deserter Pursuit. And this show is very different because the promotion for this show made it seem like it was a comedy. It is. And the promotion was so misleading. And I'm wondering if it was, I don't know if that was intentional or not. I would like to think it was intentional to make, to kind of like fool people into the story. Because the thing is like, it's almost where it's talking about the like army life, but it's also talking about the toxicity that exists in army life. And while it's set in South Korea, I think it could apply to any army around the world because, like, you know, the army, if you're a man, you have to do these things. You have to act a certain way. You have to be tough. But it talks about toxicity. It talks about toxic masculinity. It talks about bullying. It talks about psychological trauma that these soldiers, especially if they're not mentally prepared for it, can experience. And then there's extreme bullying that happens in the army. And like in South Korea, it was a really big problem. And it's gotten a bit better from, I'm speaking to someone who talked, he said it's gotten a bit better since around 2016. The show is set in 2014, but since 2016 they've been working at addressing bullying in the army, but it's still a problem there. But it talks about, I think it talks about how when you have these young men go into the army and they're not prepared, and they're into this extreme environment of toxic masculinity, how it can actually bleed over into their lives in real life. Like when they go home, they can take this same attitude and take it home, right? And take it into their work life, because like there's this whole thing about hierarchy. Right, so as long as you're higher than someone in rank, you like they people see that as a up, as a weight, as a way to bully people, and you use that as a way to bully. And then the person that's above that other person bullies the person that's below them, going on and going on, and even up to like generals or whoever. Like the generals are still subject to like some kind of bullying or intimidation. So it talks about how like this whole cascade effect of bullying, and it was really good. It's really dark. I would caution anyone, if you watch this, it's on Netflix, to be cautious of extreme scenes of bullying, suicide, violence, and like they don't really shy away from it, which I think is important because it's talking about how these things can affect men mentally. But they all like, yeah, there's a scene with a suicide. I was like, wow, okay. And that happens in, because it's six episodes, and it happens at the end of, in the middle of episode six, to so beware, because it's someone who shoots themselves in the head and you're not prepared for it. I was not, because I thought the camera was going to cut away. It did not.
Oh no.
But it's like the camera is, yeah, like the camera isn't like right there, but it's like a two camera shot, so it's like one out of sight and one like further in the distance, so you can still, but it's like, woo, okay. So, but I would caution anyone to watch it. But I think it's a really good show. It's really well produced. I love Jung Hae-in, and he's one of my favorite actors. He's in Something in the Rain and One Spring Night, which is also on Netflix. And then the other drama I'm going to talk about is, I think, is The Devil Judge. So The Devil Judge is also another one. Did I talk about this? No, because the last time I talked about Hospital Playlist. So The Devil Judge is one that I also watched recently. And this one talks, is kind of set in a sort of few in like they don't say exactly how much years in the future it is in South Korea, but I'm gonna guess probably like 10, 15 years. So it's a near future dystopic world where everything isn't completely in shambles, but you can see the progression of how things could start to like erode politically and also societally. So I think it's a really good show because it's talking about how society, if we have corrupt politicians, if they are not reined in and if the people don't sign up to corrupt politicians, how society can start to fall apart in these very small and specific ways. But then it also talks about the judicial process and how people like the law is the law. But if you have
Right.
corrupt interpretations of the law, if you have corrupt judges interpreting the law to fit them, and if you have corrupt politicians who are enacting bills and laws that are corrupt, like it's going to be a problem. You can't say the law that everyone has to obey the law when the law is not fairly as is Hobbes and Law. It's a philosophical thing with laws. Like, is it is Socrates? I could be wrong. But the word is, but the phrase is, an unjust law is no law at all, and the people have and the people have a right to rebel. So like it talks about anarchy. Like if the law is unjust, the people do are not bound to obey the law. So that's kind of what the show is about, and it's talking about revenge. Like it, Ji Sung, who's the main actor, he looks so hot, but I'm being thirsty. Yes, it's true.
I mean, I'm down. Like you said, hot revenge.
Hot revenge, and like he's a very complex character, and like he has a traumatic past because of course he does, but his traumatic past has more to do has kind of I think ties into the story beautifully because there's this other character who Rorun, played by Rorun, who is like this other judge, and he's a young one, and he's idealistic about the law, and he's like, we have to obey the law, we have to do things this way. And Ji-sun's character, Gaon, is like, you're so naive, like, oh, you sweet summer child kind of thing. Really have no idea of the world that you've entered into because Johan thought that politics and law don't mix. And Gahon is like, yeah, it does. Politics very much influences the law, and the politicians that are making enacting these laws, they're the ones who are manipulating everyone. And so he says that this struggle between idealism and pragmatism and pessimism, right? So it's a really interesting concept for a show. And it's kind of like the thing is, it's centered around these trials where it's set in the public arena. It's in a courtroom, but it's like the public gets to vote on the sentences,
Got
so
it.
they determine if someone is guilty. But the problem is like someone could end up getting sentenced to either prison for life, but or you know sentenced to they had an extradition treaty with Texas of all things, but I have a theory on that way because it's talking about the conservatism of South Korean society. But that's a whole thesis I would have to get into someday. But they have a whole thing, and like the people use an app to vote, like if this person's guilty, and then if they're guilty, then the judges decide. Okay, so we're going to decide what your sentence will be. But the thing is, sometimes the people don't understand the ramifications of their actions. And the story the show is talking about is like people get so caught up in the whole hype that they don't consider the long-term effects. So that's, I think, something that the show addresses really well, especially talking about social media, because it's talking about the like people get caught up in the hype of social media, but they don't really think about the consequences of social media.
It's very much like the Dark Mirror, the Black Mirror episode with the ups and the downs. Like people will, you just being petty and you think it's petty that you give me a down, but then that could destroy someone's credit rating or their job or like their performance and all these other things. That's something that follows them throughout their life. Like, honestly, I wouldn't want to give random people in the public my life to judge, like to put my freedom in their hands, because look at what the media does. Look how people are so easily swayed by, like, I mean, we're not gonna go there, but like people are literally easily swayed by like certain terrible graphics on Facebook when they're convinced that, oh, well, I saw this thing. I'm like, you saw it, but you have no true information about it. You haven't researched about it, but you're passing judgment on it. And why?
And it's the same thing happens in the show because they talk about where if you because like they talk about how the media manipulates stories, and the media decides what they want to show, and they don't show, so that can skew people's perspective, right? And And that's something that Gaon does. Like he like because people love him because he's handsome and he's charismatic. And he does use that to his advantage. But then at the end of the day, he's always like, you people need to start thinking critically for yourself as a society and individually, because your actions will affect everything. And he's kind of portrayed as this anti-hero. Because it seems like he's doing these things with using the first means, like manipulating witnesses and stuff. And then he was like, the game is rigged, so why can't I play the game to like benefit me and to benefit others? Because he's like, you know, it's kind of like the ends justify the means situation, right? And he's kind of showing, like, he's like, the law itself is corrupt, so how am I the person, how are you going to judge me for making the system work the way it should by, you know, fudging a little bit of fast? And he doesn't do anything to hurt anyone. And then I think also another thing is his niece, she's disabled, she's in a wheelchair. And I love that this show never really makes that a focal point of her character, that she just is. And no one mentions her disability with regards to like says it like an insult. No one speaks about her as less than just because she's in a wheelchair. And the only time they talk about her, like her disability, is with regards to how she became disabled, because it happened in an accident. But it's not like she's just disabled, right? And I love that. And I think South Korea TV shows and dramas are getting better with regards to handling characters with disabilities. So I think they did a really good job of that show. And that one is not on Netflix. It is on Viki, but I don't think you need a Viki membership to watch it, because it's on the standard channel. So anyone can go on the Viki site and watch it. So I would recommend those two shows, DP on Netflix and The Devil Judge on Viki.
Awesome. I like it. I might have to, I will definitely check that out on Viki for sure. And of course the other show too, because I'm like, I'm gonna even it out, because they balanced each other out, it sounds like.
They do. And The Devil Judge, the production quality, the outfits. There's this character, she's evil as hell, and she's another one where I'm just like, lady, this is sexual assault. I can't stand her character. And this is something I got into a bit when I talked about it on my podcast for Beyond the Romance, about how I think Korean dramas do need to do better at showing that women can sexually assault men, and it should be called out as such. That aside, her costumes, her outfits, she did not leave the house looking less than perfect.
Okay.
Props to the stylists and the wardrobe department who worked on The Devil Judge. Everyone was laying, okay? Suits were tailored to perfection.
Well, I'm excited.
I want all of her shoes.
I am excited. I can't wait to watch that one. Okay then. So then now we will go ahead and dive on into the films. So I have two, and I will just dive on into my two real quick. First one up is Candyman, the 2021 film, directed by Nia DaCosta, screenplay written by Jordan Peele, Wynn Rosenfeld, and Nia DaCosta. So I'm not gonna give like a full synopsis off of it, just because like I feel like y'all definitely should just go and see it. But like, I think it is very important that you go watch the first Candyman, and then you watch this Candyman. And I say that because the premise is that you have this artist. He recently hears about the legend of candy, about Candyman, and it's through then visiting Cabrini Green, the Chicago projects, which is a real place, which just I understand people don't like assume that this was not a real place, but yes, Cabrini Green was an actual real place in Chicago. It was a place. So he goes and visits there. He meets this man. He learns about the legend of Candyman, and he's inspired to use it in his next art installation. Unbeknownst to him, he plays the game, which, you know, he like does this whole piece about how like he tries to, well, he does succeed in doing it. Like his whole piece is about explaining to people like what does it mean, and like the whole thing that happened, and he researches it, and like he has this very intricate piece about Candyman and the legend and the lore. And he has his art installation, but then he, unbeknownst to him, summons Candyman by saying his name five times in the mirror. I'm safe. I'm saying it in the camera. And I can't, and it's not a
You don't play
reflection.
that. Black people don't play that.
I don't play that game. I don't play that game here.
You see,
It don't work. Not with me. no, no. And you have to do it in the mirror.
I'm not doing it in a mirror or on a screen, because technically I'm looking at myself and looking at you. So I'm
technically, but it's not a mirror, and I'm praying to God that that's it, and I'm done. I'm not saying his name anymore. No, but we don't play his name. But so I thought overall, I felt that it was a pretty good film. I liked it. It was very stunning shots, beautiful shots of just like Chicago. And I loved it because it's like you can recognize a lot of the places for people who, especially I think as locals, you could recognize some places and the shots that they were taking. They did the work of not just saying Chicago, like they talked about neighborhoods and different things. It's slightly two problems I had with this, and it's mainly that, okay, so Candyman from the first film, as we know, like the character, he's not so much like the whole premise about the character, like, is that he was wrongfully accused of a crime and then wrongfully punished and killed and tortured. And then he haunts like the place that he is at. And the whole thing with this one is that it does this spin on the first one, is that it is kind of like, it's telling all of these stories of Black men who had similar fates, who lived similar lives, who, like, you know, they were going about their lives and they were tortured by white people and then killed in horrendous ways. And then, like, that name is then attached to them. And it's kind of like explaining it. I'm like, okay. And then, of course, then the person, like, the reveal is that the man who tells... And there's so many characters. Sorry, my brain.
You mean it's Coleman Domingo's character?
Yeah, Anthony. Yes, Anthony McCoy. So when Anthony learns of the legend, and you say Coleman Domingo, yes, his character. He tells him it's how Black people cope. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a very deep take on it, but like a deep thing, because like, yes, like these legends, these lores, like that's a way of coping and assigning these name, like, you know, that lore to these horrendous acts. But I thought it was very creative to kind of like, okay, so, you know, that man, okay, Candyman is not it's not one person, it's a collective of people. So I'm like, okay, I thought that was a very interesting take, because you'll notice that in this film, the Candyman in the film is very different from the one that was in the first film. Mm-hmm. And they focus on that. And that's important. And that's why I'm saying it's important to watch the first film and then this film right after one another. Because honestly, I tried to get through the sequels that were made after the first film, and they are horrendous.
I've seen them, but they're kind of forgettable.
They're very forgettable. Mm-hmm. I don't know how he ends up in Louisiana. That really sticks
in your memory.
Yes, they're forgettable, and just, I don't like it. But like, you find out, and this is spoilers, y'all, and like, Carolyn, let me know if you prefer spoilers or no spoilers.
Spoil away, because then I wrote my review and I put...
Okay, that's right. You're good. And I want to hear your opinion on this too. So the reason why Coleman Domingo's character decides to summon or revive the legend is because he wants to use Candyman as a weapon of vengeance. And like on the white people who have like basically gentrified the neighborhood, like Chicago, specifically these neighborhoods like Cabrini Green. Because like, I do think they make a very poignant points about how, when we talk about the ghetto, when people want to talk about, oh, this neighborhood is up and coming now because this and that, and like, oh, and then like, it was like this one white lady film, like art critic was like, well, you guys feed off of this too, you're artists, like you love this. I'm like, and it's like, no, it's the fact that like, in order for the, like for this to happen in a community, funding gets cut off. Like, mm-hmm. It starts to fester and get infected. And then like when the funding's cut off, then the value goes down and then things like get worse and people then assign it to being a bad place. And then like so on and so forth. So that's like, and I thought that was a very great point to make. However, when the whole thing about making the, like reviving the legend to use him as an act of vengeance, I feel like it would have been stronger if somebody was like a super powerful, evil white investment banker, if one of the victims were that, And I only say that because when you think of the people that died, yes, they all benefit from gentrification.
They're all white.
And some, they're all white, and they all have benefited from some form of gentrification, and they all like, and like that's the point. But it's kind of like, I question dude's plot and like motive. Like, if you wanted to use him as a spirit, like as a spirit of vengeance, would it not make sense to go after like the people who caught, like who directly, like, yeah, no, kill the ones who did it, whatever. But like, I don't see anyone who's directly like, you know, controlling anything.
But the thing is that only happens at the end, which is why I said this
right, film. Exactly. The very end.
This film could have used, I think, 20 or 30 more minutes because it's an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And the pace is pretty steady, so you don't really feel it. So if they had added, I think, 20, 30 more minutes just to like give us a bit more into that whole vengeance is mine
kind of situation,
it would have actually worked. But the way how they ended, you definitely need a sequel for sure. But yeah. the reason I think, I don't mind that the white people that got killed, because for one thing, in the first film, mm-hmm. it was only black people that died as a result, direct result of Candyman's actions. The white people that did die were because of Helen's, who's a white woman played by, mm-hmm. why am I, it just had her name in my head and I drew a blank on it. Virginia Madsen. So her character Helen, her actions led to the deaths of white people, and also to a couple black people too, because you know mm-hmm. white people don't listen to warnings from black people at all. So that was a lesson in that too. But then the reason I think for the second one, this Nia DaCosta's film, is the reason the white people that died were not only gentrifiers, but they're also mm-hmm. people that were antagonistic and belittled.
Yes.
Belittled the work, right? So mm-hmm. that is showing like it was like a cost of not valuing black people's voice, black people's art, mm-hmm. and black people's history and the legends is death. Because right. like, you know, like those people were having sex in front, they were trying to have sex in front of the installation. And utterly disrespectful.
Disrespectful. Completely.
Exactly. The white woman that died, she was an art critic, and she completely tore apart his piece. And like, as you said, she called it derivative, and said like, and accused him, a black man, of mm-hmm. using, of exploiting black art. Like, excuse me, he's a black man. How can he be exploiting his own history and his own art when he's not? Like, he's talking about the history of black people.
He's actually literally trying to bring attention to exactly. like the legend, to shine a light on the fact of like exactly. what actually happened to the man behind the legend.
Exactly. Accusing a black man of gentrifying his own art. Stupid.
Right.
But then the also smart thing with that is, if you look at her, she bears a striking resemblance to Virginia Madsen, which I think was a really good callback to this first film, but also to the mm-hmm. character of Helen herself, because it kind of shows how white women continue to perpetuate certain behavior, like all like, you know, kind of say that like, all white women like kind of behave the same way. But I also think it was just a nod and a really smart casting to get an actress who does look like Virginia Madsen. And but the whole thing with Coleman Domingo's character, Anthony, turning Yaya DaCosta's character, help me with his name.
It's Anthony.
Oh, he's Anthony.
Yeah, no, Anthony. Thing's
character is Andrew.
William. Murphy. He's the laundromat owner.
Yeah, why am I coming out all kind of random names? But yes, Anthony. The thing that I could see why they had William turn Anthony into what he's seen as a personification of Candyman, because he for once saw Candyman inhabiting Anthony, right? He saw the interest, and he saw the spirit of Candyman, because he was one of the few people who saw Candyman kill someone, and that kind of like messed up his head as a child. And so I kind of saw where they were going, because they're talking about how black people can sometimes use other black people to further their own agenda if you're talking about advocacy. Or you know what I mean? So I kind of saw that that scene does have body horror, because it does, in spoiler, involve him cutting off his hand very graphically.
Yeah.
And props to the makeup department, because how Anthony's body changes as it becomes more possessed by the spirit of this ghost is his body literally rots away, and it starts to look like a beehive, because it has all these little holes like a beehive. And it was so gross, like the makeup department, the prosthetics they put on him were gross. So like, you
It's like holes in his neck, and my biggest thing,
oh, his whole right side of his, I was like, oh,
my biggest gross. My biggest thing that makes me cringe is like holes, like especially clusters of holes on
yeah,
skin.
I have like trypophobia, so it's just like, oh.
And they did a great job with it, but it was like it all started with like the bee sting, and then you see how it like gets worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, which I saw as kind of how gentrification starts as like this one thing, and then it spreads to the whole neighborhood is corrupted. But then they also use the analogy of bees representing cops and how they can over like when like black people are in distress, like
swarm.
Cops swarm on black people and swarm on black communities and end up killing black men and black women and black children, and then in a broader sense killing black community, killing the spirit of the black members of the community, because even if the people still surround, like their spirit has been damaged in some way, it's been traumatized in some way. So like Anthony's body represents the black community and the black experience and black trauma and black mentality. But oh, good lord, ooh,
it was a lot. But to your point, and I agree, because it was like that last 10 minutes of the film when there's the shootout with the cops, yes, it completely makes sense how he becomes then a spirit of vengeance. And like now I'm like, yes, now you actually are getting the revenge that is sought out, because you have, there's the whole exchange between Anthony's girlfriend, who's played by our girl Captain Marvel, Tiana Paris, and it's like there's that whole exchange that the cop tries to get her to say, like, basically frame her or to pin it all on him. And we know this is many times what happens in the cases with black women and black men when their partners have been killed in a fire. Like, look at what happened with Breonna Taylor. Like, it's like all these things happen, and people want to, like, well, if you could, like, one way we could see this is you helped them kill the people and you held them down, or you were a victim. And it's just like, it's so frustrating, but it was so like real to see that whole exchange, and then how she truly uses like the revival of Candyman to get vengeance, like revenge for Anthony.
Yeah.
Because I will say, I feel for Anthony in this, but it's like, I get it. Like the whole point, and I say it again, I can't stress this enough to our listeners. Y'all have to watch the first film.
Yes.
Then you watch this film, because it ties in. And I don't want to ruin what ties it all in, but it's kind of like Anthony does. He's like, it's his fate is an unfortunate fate, but this is a horror. There was never going to be a happy ending in this film. There was never going to be a happily ever after. And I think it just speaks to Anthony being like succumbing to the unfortunate fate that may happen to like when you are black and you're just like in a situation and then you can't escape it. He's cursed. Essentially, he's cursed when he gets stung. And then there's nothing he can do. Well, he's cursed once he summons Candyman. And he did that on his own. But the whole point is like, yeah, it was unfortunate this happened to him, but it's like he did summon him. So it's like, I just felt bad. I was like, oh, how is he going to break it? And then I realized, oh no, he's not going to break it. Yes. So, but I think it was a very well done towards the end and it made more sense. But like that first like reveal and like the second half of the movie, I was just like, I need you to make it make more sense, because you're right. Even the high school students, I get it, because they were terrible to the black student who came into the bathroom. Yeah. And I can't remember what they called her, but it's very clear that they use some like derogatory terms, and like they obviously like not the N-word or anything, but
they were bullying her.
And it's just like the fact that like, yeah, no, she was spared because she didn't do anything.
Well, and she was also, because she was hiding out in the bathroom stall. Smart girl. She didn't go peeping out.
She didn't go look. She didn't go look. I'm sure as long as you don't look and you don't say his name, you good.
But she didn't even know. She didn't even know what was going on, because the reason those girls got killed is because the head girl, the leader, was at the art show. And she was like just dismissive of the art piece. She just saw the inscription. She didn't read the history of it. She doesn't know the history of it. Exactly. She was like, oh, don't say the name. Don't say this name 5 times. And she didn't read the rest of it. She didn't read about the caution. She didn't read about the history of trauma. And that was why, because they took it as a game. They took it lightly. And the fact that it happened after they were building this background, I saw some people saying that that was also convenient and stuff. I'm like, but it is, but they're just showing what it is because girls are bullies.
They are. I mean, I will say good on the Asian girl who left because she was like, I don't play.
Yeah, she's like,
and
not
she's
me.
like, not today. Bye. I'm like, good on you. Good on you. You smart. You got out of there. But yeah, those are my thoughts with Candyman. Shang-Chi was my other film that I saw.
Do we have time for Shang-Chi?
I think we should do a special episode for Shang-Chi. Do you want to do that?
Well, we could. I haven't seen it yet, and I don't know when it's going to be on Disney Plus. I'm hoping Marvel puts it on Disney Plus soon because
they may not after Scarlett Johansson.
They should have put it on Disney Plus. That was a setup by Marvel from the beginning, and I'm like, I got my own
Unfortunately,
personal feelings about that. Like,
yeah, they may not, but I think, yeah, I think we can also, because it just came out this month, like it kind of bleeds over. So, or like, what's the word? Overflow. So, yeah, we can do Shang-Chi another time because technically that came out this month. That is now September. So, let's flip it back to you and you can tell us about your favorite films from your film fe festival coverage.
Yes, I'm not going to go too in depth into a specific film because, as we said at the beginning, I cover two film festivals at the same time in August, the New York Asia Film Festival and Fantasia Fest. So, but I'll just talk, name some of my favorite films and the ones that I've done interviews for. So, one of my favorite films from the New York Asian Film Festival is 10 Months, written and directed by Nam Kung Sung. This was her debut feature film, and I think it's a beautiful film, and it's a really important film because it talks about how patriarchy and living in a patriarchal society can affect women during pregnancy and after pregnancy, because it talks about the expectations society has on women to bear children, but it doesn't want to help them at, with the responsibility of raising children. But then it also expects women, oh, if you get pregnant, especially in South Korea, because South Korea is a very conservative society. So it talks about, oh, if you're pregnant, you should raise this baby with the man that you got pregnant by, your boyfriend, and you should get married. But then it's not talking about, like, everyone isn't compatible for marriage. That like, you can be dating someone and you can get pregnant, but just because you got pregnant during this relationship doesn't mean that you should tie yourself to this one person for life, because like that person is not necessarily who you're meant to marry, and then also that person is not necessarily responsible, would be a responsible husband or father, which is something that comes out in the film. But then it also talks about abortion, because up until December of 2020, abortion was illegal and partially criminalized in South Korea. Like, women could face prison sentences up to, I think, a year. Especially if something went wrong during the like the abortion procedure, and they had to pay, or you could get fined for an abortion. So, but women did have abortions, but it was done in unsafe environments, and if it was done at a clinic, like the doctor who performed it could face like legal consequences of performing abortions. So it was decriminalized in December of 2020, but up until now, 2021, women are still trying to have the society and government accept abortions, one, and help women with abortions, because it should be considered a medical right. It should be something that should be helped with, financially. Like, here in Canada, you can get abortions legally, and I think it's also covered partially by our health insurance. So that's what South Korea is trying to do too. And like, we know in America, like, abortion was illegal in like up on like. Like, what's going on in Texas now actually reflects perfectly in this film. Like, they talk about it. I think it and this film came out. So I watched the film in August, but it premiered in some South Korean festivals like earlier this year. And like, it's so, I'm not even, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. It's not coincidental, but it's like serendipitous.
Serendipity.
Yeah, that was happening in Texas is like kind of perfectly encapsulated in this film, and it kind of shows that while a film may be set in one particular country, that it can still apply to women all around the world, because there's things we relate to. We relate to, like, families saying, oh, we need to get married by a certain age, have kids by a certain age, but then they don't want to help you deal with the consequences of that. And then it also talks about the emotional toll a pregnancy can have on a woman, like, with their postpartum depression. And then there's, the sense of losing yourself as a person during pregnancy and after pregnancy. And then it talks about the confusion, like, every woman, like, pregnancy isn't something you're born knowing. Like, when you get pregnant, you're just like, what is going on with my body? You know, your body's changing, and like that can have an emotional toll on you. And then it talks about the she talked briefly about the mortality rate, because like women die during pregnancy and I can die during birth. And it made me think about how in North America, in particular, Black women, the mortality rate for Black women during pregnancy and during birth is very high, right? And that's something that the society, apart from Black people, don't really address or don't even seem to care about. So if you can, I'm don't know if the film will become available for streaming platforms, but I'm hoping it do. I could see it going on like Netflix, or Amazon Plus. But that was one of my favorite films. You can read my interview with Nam Kum Sung on the But Why the podcast site. And another film that I really liked was, I'm going to talk about this one. It's an action, Raging Fire, starring Donnie Yen and Nicholas Su. This one is a like, if you love Hong Kong action films, everyone's talking about Shang-Chi and talking about Hong Kong action films. But I'm like, listen, if you people were really paying attention, you would have been watching Hong Kong action films like me since the 90s or before. I grew up watching Hong Kong action films, okay? Like, these films are nothing. I used to people talking about, oh my God, we have our Asian superhero. I'm like, excuse me, Jackie Chan is a superhero. That man been out there flipping off back of buses, hanging off of chandeliers. That's a superhero right there. If you want to talk, you know, like you got Donnie Yen, Ip Man. Ip Man is a legend in martial arts, and Donnie Yen has been playing Ip Man for the last about 15 years. He's been in three Ip Man films. No, technically four, because there's Ip Man 1, 2, 3. Then there was Ip Man Masters, Legend of Master Z. It stars Michelle Yeoh, but that one is kind of like a spin-off. But then there's Ip Man 4 with Donnie Yen. And like, Donnie Yen has been kicking ass for how long? You had Bruce Lee in Enter the Dragon doing heroic shit, people. Like, and so like, I gotta talk about Raging Fire because like, this is like in perfect late 90s, early 2000s Hong Kong action cinema. And it's directed by the late Benny Chan, who unfortunately died at the end of production. And this film, I just love the action sequences. It's like crazy good. And the plot may be predictable, but that's the beauty of Hong Kong action films is like, even though that you can tell the certain beats and where the plot is going, it's the execution that makes it all worthwhile. You know what I mean? It's all how they do stunts. The stunt sequences in this film are amazing. Nicholas Su and Donnie Yen like go head to head. I want to see them in another film together because this is their first film together. And the thing is, Nicholas Su doesn't normally do action films. He actually is known for TV for Chinese dramas, and he had a Chinese food show for like 5 years. So he's like a foodie and he's like a chef. And you
Donnie is a
know,
chef?
Not Donnie and Nicholas Su, the
Oh,
other.
I'm sorry. I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, no, Nicholas Su. So he's known for like kind of like variety shows, and he had his own like variety show, so like he can cook it. He can knock it out on set, and he can knock it out in a kitchen too. But I would love to see them in another film together, probably as partners. And it's really good because it's, you know, it's about corruption in the police departments, and like Donnie Yen's character is this very altruistic, very pragmatic, and he has this very strict honor code, and he expects everyone to adhere to this. But he also has a very sly sense of humor, I think, and a slight taste of pettiness, because there's a scene that made me laugh. I was like, hee, that's my type of petty right there. And then Nicholas's character is like his protege, who because of this, he killed a man, unfortunately. And Donnie Yen's character, kind of like in court, said, "Yeah, you did. You killed him." And Nicholas's character was like, "I expected you to back me up." And Donnie Yen was like, "Well, I can't really like understand." So like, he went to prison, came out, and then it's like this whole thing of like betrayal and angst and badassery and like crazy ass stunts. And the thing with this film is like, I've seen some of the behind the scenes footage, like a lot of like, even like for me as for you, like the two of us, like people who cover film and talk about it professionally, like sometimes we forget how much of these films, everything we're seeing is CGI and VFX. And when I saw the behind the scenes footage for this film, I'm like, yo, they did such a fantastic job with the VFX in this film. Like, props to the production team and the VFX crew and the stunt team. Because, like,
Well,
yes.
awesome.
Like, Raging Fire is distributed by Wago USA, so you can go online. It's showing in cinemas, but I think it's going to be available for DVD soon. So if you can watch it, please do safely. Of course, if you're going to watch it in the cinema, I'm really not technically advocating for cinema because I personally think that people should stay home, you know, because this pandemic is raging. But if you're gonna go, be safe. And if you can find it online once it becomes available, watch it because I had a ton of fun with this film. Donnie Yen is Donnie Yen.
Yes.
Because I the two of them together. What?
Yes. I just want to add, if y'all do go to theaters, please wear your mask. Like, please wear your mask and keep it on. It's fine if you want to get popcorn. And I say this because, like, I have just now gotten comfortable enough to feel to go to the film, like, movie theaters again. But I try, like, and this isn't for everybody. Y'all ain't got to do what I do. I choose to go to the smaller theaters with the smaller screen, so I'm not in a bigger crowd. I choose, like, to select a seat where, like, I know no one's going to sit next to me, where at least, like, there's a wall or something.
Or double up because you're in an enclosed air-conditioned space.
That too. I mean,
please.
Too. But just be safe. Just be, if, like, if you're going to go to the theaters, yes, I definitely am not advocating for, you know, like, people who are not vaccinated and not taking precautions to go. Mm-hmm. But, like, if you're going to go and you have not been vaccinated, you need to be taking all the precautions necessary to go into public spaces, just like everybody else is. That's it. But yeah, just be safe and don't be gross. And remember to cough into your armpit. Just because I tell you real quick, the person to one seat away from me had sniffled, and I was like, oh no, no, I'm leaving. I want to leave.
There's like one or two things that I might events like for TIFF that I'm gonna think, and there's like some friends that are coming down that I'm gonna meet, and I know they've been safe that I'm gonna meet in person, but doing in-person screenings at the PNIs where people are being reckless and careless, unfortunately, I have had to come to the decision I will be doing most of my coverage digitally. I might see one or two things in PNI screenings, and even then, if I go to the cinema and see too many people inside, I'm going right back outside.
Yeah, that's all you can do. I mean, all we can do right now is take all the precautions that we need to take and to keep ourselves safe and for other people to be safe. But that does not mean anyone has to feel uncomfortable. Exactly. In these bits. And I mean, I don't want to hear the whole, like, I can't breathe in this mask uncomfortable, because
I wear two masks. I wear like the hospital grade mask and then like a cloth mask over it. When I go to the doctor, my appointments at the doctor, I wear two masks and I breathe perfectly fine. I even jog to the bus stop if I'm not exhausted. See, but again, exhausted is for other reasons. Low iron. Yep. Take care of your vitamin D.
There you go. But with that, I think that brings us a close to our show. So y'all can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Nisha Plays. That's NeyshaPlays. And Carolyn, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CarrieSandH12. That's CarrieSandH12. You can find me live tweeting dramas using the hashtag Dramas with Carrie every Saturday night at 10 p.m. Eastern. I do Saturday Night Sci-Fi with my co-host, and we do films, TV shows from all across the world, usually on either curated list through YouTube or Netflix, Disney Plus, or we've done a couple on Amazon. And you can find both mine and Nisha's writing on the But Why the Podcast site. You can find our festival coverage and our film reviews, as well as other podcast episodes on podcast streaming platforms. You can find my YouTube channel under my name, Carolyn Hines, as well as my playlist. You can see Carolyn Talks, where I do interviews with industry creatives. And also Beyond the Romance, which is where I talk about Korean and other Asian dramas. You can find episodes on that on YouTube channel, as well as butwhythepodcast.com and other streaming platforms. And I think that is it for us. This is a great chat. We've had fun. We talked about some really good shows and really good films. And also, like we mentioned, the books. And also, you mentioned Blood, Dark Blood, which, as I said, Latoya Morgan is the writer. But I forgot to mention, she was also the writer on Walking Dead and Fear the Walking Dead. She has worked on both shows because she had a writer's deal with AMC. So that
was awesome. Look at that. It's all connected.
All connected.
With that, I guess this is goodbye until next time. But y'all remember to hit us up. Let us know what you are watching and reading. Or if y'all just want to ask us questions, y'all can always hit us up and we'll get back to you.
Yes.
But with that,
stay safe, everyone.
Yes, stay safe. Bye.